I believe that Paul calls this horn in Daniel 7 the man of lawlessness, or the law of sin, of the man of sin. He's referring to a rebellion and apostasy, a falling away, apostasia, the spirit of disobedience to God, mystery of iniquity. In Daniel 2 and Daniel 7, the symbols usually refer to national powers rather than individuals. The kings are named as founders and representatives of kingdoms or empires. And the ten horns represent ten kingdoms rather than individual kings. The king represents the kingdom, and the kingdom is concentrated in its king. The beast was given in verse 7 I'm not sure where I am on the slides at this point, but the beast was given authority over every tribe and people and language and nation. I view this as the Roman Empire with its ten kingdoms, the Roman world, as in Luke 2:1. All the world is the Roman world. Who worships the beast? Those whose names were not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. Those not included, they don't include those who were sealed in chapter 7 or who are seen by John. Many who died in this war of the beast against the saints died singing hymns of praise. And that is represented a little later on here. Let me catch up on the slides where I am. One of the points I wanted to make is that the failure of the Roman Church in our time to prosecute heretics, even within her own priesthood, is evidence of the fall of Babylon that we see in 16, 17, and 18. They would be doing this if they could. They always did it when they could. If the Pope is Lord of the land, he will never tolerate you. And when we see the Pope on TV doing nice and gentle things, we need to remember that this man represents a power that will shed the blood of saints if he can. But that power was taken away after the time of the 1260 years. Pope Pius V declared that he would release a guilty culprit, a culprit guilty of 100 murders rather than one obstinate heretic. So, to me, this is one of the most convincing evidences of the fall of Babylon. When he wielded universal sway, millions were tortured and slain. The Quebedero at Madrid. There was a man from the same family as the people that started the Guinness Brewing Company, but his name was Henry Grattan Guinness, and he wrote about personal first-hand experience going to this place in Madrid when that trench was opened for highway construction. When the Quemadero was opened in Madrid in 1970 and the ashes of the martyrs who had been burned by the Inquisition, this is 1870, the ashes of the martyrs who had been burned by the Inquisition were brought to light, we were present and saw that thick bank of human remains and stood breast deep in the ashes. There's another traveler who wrote an account of this. In the early part of 1870, I crossed the Pyrenees and reached Madrid. And on reaching Madrid, went with a friend to see the newly opened Quemadero. Some workmen employed in cutting a road across the summit of a low hill close to the city had inadvertently dug into a broad bank of ashes which had been buried for one or two centuries. Mingled with the ashes, they found a large quantity of charred human bones, together with fragments of rusted iron and melted lead. The spot was speedily verified as the famous Quemadero, or place of burning, one of 12 places where so-called heretics were annually burned in Spain during the Inquisition. I found the road had been cut through the center of this bank of blackened bones and ashes. The strange stratum displayed seemed about 6 feet in depth and covered quite a large area. There, exposed to the light of day, were the ashes of the Spanish martyrs. It's quite a story. This was discovered in the same year that the Pope was declared to be infallible. We have quite a lot of information about this. Guinness says, "We have seen in Mexico skeletons of victims of the Inquisition who had been buried alive. We have visited the Inquisition in Rome and have seen its prisons and conversed with its inquisitors. Its history, written in tears and blood, fills next to the story of the crucifixion of Christ, the darkest page in the records of humanity." This is something that, and Gisela Mueller is just a common person who wrote this into a magazine. "I grew up in a Roman Catholic family in Hitler's Germany. One day when the Nazis had committed yet another act of church persecution, my mother angrily said, 'Why can't they leave the church alone?' My dad quietly answered, 'It could be worse. They could be buddies.'" And that's the type of thing that we're talking about here. How does Papal Rome blaspheme God? Papal claims to divine authority are well documented. The papal claims to be uniquely ordained and represent God on earth have been stated over and over again. Many popes have not only claimed to take the place of God on earth, but to be equal to God and even to be God. Examples: Leo XIII, June 20th, 1894. "We hold the place of Almighty God on earth," he said. Pope Pius IX, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." Pius XI, April 30th, 1922. "You know that I am the Holy Father, the representative of God on the earth, the vicar of Christ, which means that I am God on the earth." Cardinal Manning, a good friend of Pope Pius IX, said that the papal church is totally supreme, or it is nothing or worse than nothing, an imposture and a usurpation. That is, it is Christ or Antichrist. And I have to agree, it is one or the other, Christ or Antichrist. The papacy has openly claimed to be a law unto itself, to have authority to change existing laws, whether ecclesiastical or civil, even to have the authority to change the laws of Christ. Pope Gregory IX wrote that the Pope is said to have a heavenly power, and hence he changes even the nature of things. He can make something out of nothing. A judgment which is null, he makes to be real. In the things which he wills, his will is taken for reason. Nor is there anyone to say to him, "Why dost thou this?" For he can dispense with the law. He can also turn injustice into justice by correcting and changing the law, and he has the fullness of power. Pope Nicholas decreed, "No marvel if it be in my power to change times and laws, to alter and abrogate laws, to dispense with all things, yea, with the precepts of Christ." The Pope is judge and can be judged by no one. And in their heyday, of course, the popes were kings as well as priests. And that's what we're really talking about here, the temporal power united with the spiritual power. They claim to be subject to no power on the earth and to be king of kings. And for ages they acted accordingly to that. The spiritual authority attached to the Pope gave him headship over the kings. And this was the principle of his usurpations. This authority derived from his being the supposed successor of the Apostle Peter. The Roman papacy speaks clearly as Antichrist, that is, a counter Christ, a substitute Christ. The Apostle John said, "You have heard that Antichrist is coming." Where did they hear that? They had to hear it someplace. John said they heard it. Probably a reference back to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 about the man of sin. A substitute Christ, a vice Christ, or anyone who takes the place of Christ. 1 John 2:18, 22, 4:3, and 2 John 7 are the places where this expression is used, and it was apparently well known in the early church. "You have heard that Antichrist is coming." Obviously, there was a spirit of Antichrist. The Apostle John said in his day, there are many of them already who have this spirit, and they are Antichrist. This can mean one who stands in opposition to Christ, or one who puts himself in the place of Christ, another Christ, setting himself up as the counterpart of the true Christ. As an antitype takes the place of a type, the church is the tabernacle. The tabernacle is a type of the church, the true tabernacle which the Lord pitched and not man. Antitype denotes a relationship of correspondence between the symbol and the thing symbolized. Antichrist denotes not per se one who rejects the person or teaching of Christ, but one who, as a rival, usurps the office and prerogatives of Christ. He sits in the temple of God proclaiming himself to be God. He is the head of the great apostasy predicted by Paul. I always duck down when I take a drink so I don't make you thirsty. He's the little horn having eyes like the eyes of man and a mouth speaking great swelling things. A pseudo-apostolical anti-Christ who thus sets Christ aside while in mouth confessing him and professing himself in the place of Christ to be the power of God. The word anti-pope was sometimes used in exactly the same way. A rival pope, one who claims to be the pope but is really a rival usurper of that office. There's a system, a spirit to every system of teaching. In John's day, a class of teachers had arisen within the church claiming to be inspired, who denied that Christ had come in the flesh. The Gnostics were one permutation of the spirit of Antichrist. They degraded both the deity and the humanity of Christ. They failed to confess the true union of the divine Christ with his human nature. To pervert the essential doctrine of Christ by word or action is to deny him. The idea of Antichrist is not connected with atheism, but with heretical Christianity. All false teachers are of an anti-Christian spirit, even when they pretend to be of Christ, and even though they teach much that is true. But the common first century expectation of a future Antichrist was probably based on Paul's prediction of the man of sin, the son of perdition, 2 Thessalonians 2. John is saying that many have already come in that spirit, but that you have heard that Antichrist is coming. The spirit of Antichrist, again, is not an outright repudiation of the messiahship of Jesus. The Pope claims the prerogative of Christ in forgiving sins. He sits in the seat of Christ on earth as the vicar of Christ in a vicarious way. This is true. He who speaks for Christ must either be his true ambassador or antichrist. If the Pope does not really speak for Christ, then he is, in some sense, antichrist. If he's not the vicar of Christ, then he must be the other. I don't see any middle view on this. Pope Pius IX stated, "I am the vicar of Jesus Christ, and I have the right to employ the very words of Jesus Christ. My Father, those whom thou hast given me, I will not lose." Pope Pius X said, "The Pope is Jesus Christ himself, hidden under the veil of flesh. All must be subject to him." The doctrine that the Pope is the vicar of Christ is fundamental to Roman Orthodoxy. The Roman Catholic Church is on the side of Satan. And it's possible to have the spirit of truth or a love of the truth while having some error. Conversely, it's possible to have the spirit of error while holding some truth, being motivated by the same spirit as that which characterizes the world. The prediction that there was another king that was going to arise, different from the earlier ones, that was the prediction in Daniel 7. You've got 10 horns, and then you've got another little horn that comes out of that. The saints will be handed over to him for a time, times, and half a time. The judgment shall sit at the end of Daniel 7, 25, 26. The judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end. The popes, in their reinterpretation of Scripture, annul marriages. They annul the commandment against the idolatry of images. They withhold the communion cup from the laity when Jesus said, "Drink ye all of it." They worship saints and angels. Pope Pius IX said in 1912, "The Pope is the head under whom no one can feel himself tyrannized over because he represents God himself. He is the Father par excellence because he unites within himself all that there is that is lovable, sacred, and divine." The Pope is called the husband of the church, signified by the marriage ring in his inauguration ceremony. Now, the beast from the earth in verses 11 through 18 is a different institution, a different entity. Daniel, from his far different distant view of these times, saw only one beast here. Like we look at a binary star from way off and may just see one star. John is much closer and getting more detail. He sees the beast from the sea accompanied by another beast and by the image of the beast. These are the great earthly helps to the first beast. Out of the earth probably emphasizes the false prophet from chapter 16, 13 and chapter 19, 20. There's a close association here with human society, the earth. The two horns may be intended to indicate his lamb-like appearance. Spoke as a dragon shows his deceitful, the deceitfulness of this entity. The second beast is definitely a subordinate and a helper of the first. It's the prime minister of the first. The lamb-like appearance suggests his pseudo-redemptive role in the imitation of the true lamb. The description would have reminded the first century reader of the imperial cult and its priesthood, which made the people worship the Roman emperor back at the end of the first century. Ancient sources say this cult was transferred from Babylon to Pergamum, where for a time the kings of Pergamum were worshipped as gods in their temple by means of its priests. When Pergamum fell to the Romans, their worship was transferred to the Roman emperors, and the Roman imperial cult became the official state religion. But the first century readers would have understood that they were living under the sixth head, the pagan Roman Empire, and that this prophecy looks ahead to a seventh, which would be killed and resurrected as an eighth. They could have concluded that the implied priesthood, though much like the pagan priesthood in their own day, pertained to some future times. The Lord warned his followers, "Watch out that nobody deceives you, for many will come in my name claiming I am the Christ and will deceive many. For false Christ and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect if that were possible." So we should be on the alert to detect things that are false. In chapter 13, verse 12, this beast exercised all the authority of the first beast, and it exercised it on his behalf, and made the earth and the inhabitants worship the first beast. Like the first beast, which functions as an instrument of Satan, so this beast exercises the same satanic power. He functions as an intermediary priestly, in an intermediary priestly manner between the first beast and the people. He is seen to perform great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven in full view of man. The apparent miracles of the beast from the earth mimic those of the true witnesses. This beast from the earth, called the false prophet in chapter 19, is seen in order it sets up an image in honor of the first beast. He orders the people to do this. The idea was clear to the people in the who first read this, I think, because of the priest in the imperial cult. They were requiring the people in Ephesus and elsewhere to worship an image that was the likeness of Domitian in the form of a colossal statue at Ephesus. They knew the book of Revelation was presented in symbolic language, so they wouldn't have expected this to be a literal image, but they were familiar with the idea of an image. So they would have understood that the image was going to be something that reflects the character of the first beast, something that would be able to effectively communicate for the false prophet in requiring the worship of the first beast. I believe that the beast from the earth, the false prophet, is the Roman Catholic priesthood or the clergy, and especially with a special emphasis here on the College of Cardinals, who are the upper echelon in this hierarchy and make a lot of important decisions. It functions contemporaneously with the beast from the sea. It's a deceptive entity which seems to be mild and gentle and inoffensive. It ensured the torture and death of countless witnesses to the true gospel. Bishops were bishops by the grace of the apostolic seed, not by the grace of God. The bishops, or the abbot's mitre, was anciently, today it's cleft from left to right, but it used to be cleft from front to back and could even give the appearance of horns. They used to be called cornuti, the horned ones. In the days of a number of the popes, there was a medal that was created of the pope seated upon his throne. And I don't know if you can see the writing there or not. Over here, quaem creant adorant. I don't know if that, maybe you can see it better on this one. That last one was from Leo X. This one is from Martin V. Maybe you can see I think you can see the printing a little better on this one. Quaem creant adorant at Rome. Meaning, in the Latin language, whom they create, they adore. Just not too long ago, you saw the College of Cardinals got together over in Rome to have a conclave to pick a new pope because the other one had resigned. And these medals were very commonly used at one time. Here's one from Eugene. That may not be quite as clear. But this was on the back side. You see the pope is seated upon his throne and being attended by his helpers who had created him to that office, and now they are adoring him. This is along the lines of what we have here, I believe, in this 13th chapter. I believe the image is fulfilled in the papal general councils. An image, it represents the original of which it is a likeness. The papal councils were representative in nature. Gibbon said, "It was established as a custom and a law that the bishops of the independent churches should meet in the capital of the province at the stated periods of spring and autumn. Their decrees, which are styled canons, regulated every important controversy of faith and discipline." All the provinces of the Roman world were represented by their bishops under the sanction and the presidency of the popes. It's these councils, I believe, that are the image of the beast, because that's the way the word image is used of deliberative bodies like the House of Commons or the French National Assembly. Edmund Burke said, "The virtue, spirit, and essence of a House of Commons consist in its being the express image of the feelings of a nation." Sir James Graham said, he's speaking about a reform bill which was to constitute the House of Commons a real and express image and representation of the country. The French National Assembly in 1848 was said to be a faithful and complete image of that nation. And we have this kind of language in the New Testament. Jesus Christ is the brightness of God's glory and the express image of His person. The Pope, as the head of the Roman priesthood, called for a convening of a general council. The whole preparatory process was assigned to the papal clergy. It took years, sometimes, to get this ready. To give breath to the image is to enable it to speak. Only the clergy were allowed to vote regarding ecclesiastical matters. The decisions of the councils were called canons, and the councils were said to speak them. They literally were said to speak these canons. These canons spoke what the Pope wanted to hear. It was the image of the Pope that spoke, the representation and image of the papal mind. Tradition was elevated above the Word of God. Anybody excommunicated was outside the protection of the law. Anybody could kill them. Most of the Western general councils made specific provision for the extermination of heretics. The extirpation of heretics was the object of many bulls of the councils. Death was decreed, and provision was made for accomplishing this, forbidding that any should harbor them, the heretics, while they were alive, or when dead, even give them Christian burial. Trade with heretics was forbidden by canon law. The Third Lateran Council of 1179 says it commanded that no man should entertain or cherish them in his house or land or exercise traffic with them. The Synod of Tours in 1163 specifically forbade buying and selling with heretics, as did the bull of Pope Martin at the Constance Council in the early part of the 15th century. The mark on the beast or the right hand or the forehead, the mark of the beast on the right hand or the forehead is the sign of ownership. The mark is the alternative to the seal in chapter 7, which identifies the people of God. The Antichrist would claim ownership of those who were deceived by the false prophet. The mark would be seen in those actions or characteristics which would identify a person with the Antichrist. The mark of the beast is the name of the beast or the number of his name. And we have here, near the end of the 13th chapter, the instruction to count or to calculate that number. That suggests a gematria, which is a figure of speech where the numbers are understood as corresponding letters, and the name is hidden in the numbers. The Greek word translated, "let him calculate" or "let him count," means literally to calculate with stones, implying a procedure that involved arithmetic. The abacus was already in common use at this time, and this would imply a decimal approach to the calculation, which could greatly limit the number of possibilities that could result. This same verb is used in Luke 14:28. If you build a tower, you must first calculate or count the cost. The solution needs to be one that would have been easy for the first century readers to find. John wrote in the Greek language for people who understood that tongue. Jesus said, "I am Alpha and Omega, the first and the last letters of the Greek alphabet." The Greeks did not express numbers by figures like we do, but by letters like the Romans. All of us are familiar with Roman numerals where X stands for 10 and C stands for 100. The Greek language was like that as well, and you can easily find this information online or in an encyclopedia. 666 was expressed by using letters from the Greek language in this book written in Greek. And the letters were symbols for the various quantities. Irenaeus in the second century suggested the solution that I'm going to give you because I've never seen it bested. The lambda is worth 30. It has a numerical value of 30, and I've put the English letter L there to correspond to the Greek letter lambda. Alpha corresponds to A and is 1. Tau, epsilon, iota, nu, omicron, and sigma. When we add these together, we come up with 666. And this, with the diphthong spelled out on the right there, or the gliding vowel that's used there in the Greek language, this is the Greek spelling of the name Latinos, or Latinus, the Latin man, king of the Latins and reputed founder of the Latin race. This man is mentioned a couple of times in Virgil's Aeneid, which is the story of Aeneas, a Trojan who in exile travels to Italy and is there with his men hosted by Latinus. Rome is the ancient capital of the Latins. The Romans were a Latin race. They spoke the Latin language. It was the Latin world, the Latin kingdom, the Latin church, the Latin patriarch, the Latin clergy, the Latin councils. They Latinized everything. The Roman Church is called the Latin Church to distinguish it from the Greek Church, which is the other division of the Great Schism. Roman Catholic books were written in Latin. Until recently, their worship was conducted in Latin in every country, in the Latin alone. I remember the furor that was caused when that was changed a few years ago. A lot of people in that system wanted it to be left in the Latin language alone. When a Roman Catholic council convenes, its sessions are conducted in the Latin language. The language of the emperor and all the official Roman affairs conducted, including the army, that was all in Latin. And this while the lingua franca out in the provinces was the Greek language. Latinos, Latinus, the Latin man, was a clear way of referring to anybody who represented the authority of the Roman Empire. Irenaeus in the second century said that this was the probable solution because it is the name of the last kingdom of the four seen by Daniel. And as I say, I've never seen this bested. I think that this is correct. This points ahead to a future Roman state. The beast and one of its heads, though conceivably separated in the first two verses of chapter 13, are treated as identical in verses 12 and 14. So if we discover the name of the man, it is the name of the beast. At the end of the book of Daniel, the statement is made that none of the wicked will understand, but those who are wise will understand. Here is wisdom. This calls for wisdom and understanding. Now, I think we're going to need to skip over chapter 14. Chapter 14 is very similar to chapter 7. In chapter 7, we saw two interludes and there was a sealing. In chapter 14, we go back to that after this terrible time where the saints were warred against by the beast from the sea. Then there is this interlude dropped in. We have an interlude in 7 and 14, and then in 21 we have the final, I can't say interlude because it's the final state. But I think we're going to need to skip over 14. We need to really skip 15 as well, because 15 is only 8 verses long. It's the introduction to the bowls of wrath. So I'm just going to... In chapter 14, we have three different sets of events there. And I'm just going to skip through that material, but it'll be on whatever is put out with regard to this. I'm going to just skip on over to chapter 16 since our time is running down here. Here in chapter 16, we have the bulls of wrath. Just as chapter 13 shows us the rise of the beast, so chapter 16 shows us the fall of the beast in its temporal power. That's what we're talking about here. There is allusive reference made to the plagues of Egypt. There are boils, sores, water turned to blood, and hail. That's not very helpful in determining the meaning of the language here, because the Egyptian plagues were literal and these plagues are symbolic. The general meaning of the parallel to the 10 plagues is, I think, just that God will deliver his people as he did deliver his people from the Israelites. The first century reader would have understood that the beast was a future Roman government. The judgment of God is not capricious. It's an expression of his just and righteous nature. God's holiness and justice requires blood for blood. The prediction is that he's going to end the temporal power of the little horn. The seventh trumpet with its seven bowls addresses a time after the sounding of the sixth trumpet. Each bowl, after being poured out, continues to act, though the others are added to it. The judgments of the preceding bowls overrun into succeeding ones. In verse 1 here of chapter 16, we see the great voice of God. These angels are sent out on their separate missions. Detailed are successive blows by which the temporal power of the papacy would fall. So let's get right to the first bowl here, so we don't run out of time. I don't want to do like I've done so many times before and not get to the end of where we're trying to head. The first bowl has to do with the earth as opposed to the sea, the rivers, or the sun. There is a noisome, bad sore, and it goes along or corresponds with the same idea from the sixth Egyptian plague. A boil gradually and painfully festers until it erupts. So what we're going to see here is an eruption from within, not an infliction from without. The outbreak of this ulcer is a deep-seated disease from within. This erupted in the 18th century French Revolution. There were several factors that contributed to this. One was decadence. The growing moral and spiritual decadence of the papacy and its apostate church during this time. Temporal and spiritual authority rested in the papal throne. This had been buttressed with the forged document called the Donation of Constantine. In this forged Roman imperial decree, Constantine supposedly transferred authority over Rome and the Western Roman Empire to the Pope. This was probably written in the 8th century. But of course, Constantine had died in the 4th, so it couldn't have come from him. But it was used a lot in the 13th century to support the claim of papal political authority. It was exposed as a forgery in the 15th century, but by then it had long since done its job. The vice and flagrant sins and public crimes of the popes of the last half of the 15th century and early part of the 16th were just blatant. Pope Alexander VI, from 1492 to 1503, secured the papal office through bribery. He fathered several illegitimate children. He conducted bacchanalian orgies right in the papal palace. We're talking about an apostate system putrid to the core. The license which expressed itself in the accumulation of great wealth through the sale of spiritual favors and indulgences was off-putting to many people. Many dismissed the entire Christian religion as unauthentic and false because of this. Many others took the papal example as license for their own immoral or violent behavior. Decadence in this system was a big part of the reason for the French Revolution. Also the persecution, the extreme atrocities authorized and committed by the Roman Church with its persecution and slaughter of dissenting Christians and Jews and others, turned people against religion and against belief in God. The main victims were believers in Christ, and especially the ones that were adamant and outspoken in rejecting the papal claims and doctrines as unbiblical. The doctrines of these groups are commonly misrepresented in the material that was written about them at the time in order to enhance the allegations of heresy. The victims were subjected to extreme forms of torture to induce them to recant, and many, many of them were burned at the stake. We've mentioned that the names derived often from their leaders or geographical locations that were given by these people by their enemies. Waldenses, Albigenses, Paulicians, Poor Men of Lyons, the Bohemian Brethren, the Wickliffites, the Taborites, the Valenses, the Valdois, and the Hussites are just a few of the many names. The savage treatment of millions of people contributed to the anti-religious enlightenment spirit which developed in these countries. And the enlightenment is a third point here. The growing popularity of enlightenment philosophies with their humanistic atheism, materialistic science, and anti-Christian thought had a marked effect, especially in France and Western Europe during these centuries. This was the time in England of Paine and Hume and Gibbon and Bolingbroke. It was the time of Frederick the Great in Germany and Jefferson and Franklin in our country. The writings of Descartes and Locke and Voltaire and Rousseau produced a spirit of independence from traditional institutions of church and state. Rationalism encouraged the enthronement of human reason and discouraged belief in God and divine revelation. These trends encouraged rebellion against the absolutism of church and state, and eventually broke out in the French Revolution. Now, France had always been the kingpin of papal power. The King of France had been known to the popes for a long time as the eldest son of the church. To a considerable degree, the state of Europe was determined by the condition of France. Napoleon said that a revolution in France is sooner or later followed by a revolution in Europe. Paris is the navel of the world. Its central position geographically, its power, its direct relation to all the purposes and all the aims of the papacy made it possible and probable that in the account of the downfall of the papal power, France would not be overlooked. The popes actually lived in Avignon, France, for the better part of the 14th century when they were driven out of Rome. All seven popes during those years were French, as were 111 of the 134 cardinals during that period of time. So France had the mark of the beast as much as any other nation did. The French Revolution is largely traceable to the corruptions of the papal religion. Apostasy from the faith always contains the germ of its own punishment. The national atheism, the licentiousness, and the bloodthirstiness were just the translation into action of the corrupt moral and social and political and religious principles that had infected this nation for a long time. Reason revolted at the incredible doctrines that people were being asked to believe. Moral sense revolted at the cruelties and oppressions of the papal system. Infidelity was the nursing offspring of that system. Indulgence was shown by that system toward infidelity as long as people outwardly conformed to the system. But infidelity grew within France and Western Europe generally until its hatred of God impelled it to become more aggressive. When it had enough adherents, it could come out into the open. So what had festered and inflamed like a boil broke out in violent war in 1789. The French Revolution was a tremendous outbreak of social and moral fury and atheism and vice. From France as a center, it spread like a plague throughout Europe to the other countries of papal Christendom. And this event was of major importance for the world. Edmund Burke, in his reflections on the revolution in France and also in his letters on a regicide peace, uses expressions like fever, epidemic, corruptions, malignant French distemper, plague. He uses these expressions again and again to describe what was going on during this time. Edmund Burke called the French Revolution the most astonishing event in human history. I'm not saying that it was, but it was that impressive to a contemporary that he called it that, the most astonishing event in human history. The age of reason was declared. There was a calculated and determined attack on the Bible and a crusade against all religion, not just against Catholicism, but against all religion, whether Christian, pagan, or whatever it was. Notre Dame Cathedral became the Temple of Reason. And this statement was made in 1792. Here and now begins a new epoch in world history. Goethe, the philosopher, made that statement. Christian funeral services were abolished. Cemeteries had to display the inscription, "Death is an eternal sleep." The French nation declared itself atheistic, and this is something that has hardly ever happened in the history of the world. It declared itself atheistic. Now, communistic nations later on did this as well in some cases. But up to this time, this had hardly ever happened. Papal power at this time received a shock from which it never recovered and from which it can never recover. The effects were just devastating for the Church of Rome. Its sources of revenue were undermined, its control over its diocese was lost, its property was confiscated. The atrocities that had been formerly committed by the Roman Church against the heretics were now done to the papal priest. What goes around came around, purposefully copied all too faithfully by a generation of people ignorant of even the first elements of the Christian faith, even though they'd been Roman Catholics up until recently. They knew nothing about the Christian faith as found in the Bible. There were shootings, drownings, roastings, etc. The symbol in verse 2 of a previously existing corruption that breaks out in ulcerations, I think, is amply fulfilled in the French Revolution. Horrors and sufferings rose out of national atheism and licentiousness and bloodthirstiness of spirit. They were just the evolution into action of the corrupt principles that had existed for a long time. These had been infused as a part of Rome's religious system by the papal beasts that the nation had worshipped. The revolution was aimed at the power of the papacy. In 5 years, 2 million people were killed. And those 2 million people included 24,000 priests. 40,000 church houses, some of them very large church houses, were turned into stables for horses. The power of the popes in France was shattered. It was determined to spread the revolution to other countries. A new calendar was adopted in 1793. It went back to part of 1792, but it was actually adopted in 1793. Then it went back to 1792, the first year of the French Republic. And they completely abandoned the old calendar because it was calculated as the year of our Lord, from the birth of the Lord Jesus Christ. There was a great emphasis on natural things, fruits and animals, plants, because these are the things we can see. We don't have to believe in God to believe that these things exist. Every day of the year was dedicated to a plant or an animal or something along that line. They had this all categorized and outlined. Every day of the year was dedicated to some natural creation. But when they came to deciding what they were going to honor on December 25th, which the Roman Church had taught was the birthday of Jesus, they decided that December 25th was to be made the day of the dog, which was intended as a slap in the face and an insult to the Lord Jesus Christ. So they've really thrown the baby out with the bathwater here. They're trying to get rid of a perverse system, but they're getting rid of a lot of things that make a lot of sense. If we take 533 as the beginning of the papacy, the 1260 years expired then in 1793. In 1793, King Louis XVI was executed on January 21st, and his queen, Marie Antoinette, was executed on October 16th, both in that year. The monuments of monarchy were destroyed. The tombs of the kings were violated. Church buildings were stripped of their valuable medals. The Bishop of Paris was prevailed upon to publicly abjure the Christian faith. We want you to publicly say that this whole thing has been a hoax. A naked prostitute was worshipped as the goddess of reason while accompanied with orgies. All the members of the French Convention live publicly with mistresses. To have done otherwise would have exposed them to the suspicion of being Christians, and the higher-ups at this time, nobody wanted to be even suspected of being a Christian. Half the births in Paris during these years were illegitimate. 48,000 revolutionary committees were established in France with a combined membership of over 500,000 people, and each of these people received 3 francs a day as his wages for seeking out victims for arrest and the scaffold where they would have their heads chopped off. Paper money was issued incessantly and wildly, resulting in total economic confusion. The value of money rapidly fell to a tenth and soon to a 20th of its face value. Debtors paid their obligations with currency that finally was not even worth 1/100th of its face value. Farmers kept raising the price of their goods in proportion to the fall in the paper money. This was just the opposite of what the people had been led to expect as the result of the revolution. The revolutionists destroyed each other in rapid succession, repeatedly proving that the noble savage is not noble, he's just savage. Finally, during the Reign of Terror in 1794, there were daily executions in the capital and just extermination out in the provinces. Moderates perished because they were inferior in wickedness to their opponents. Virtue seemed powerless. Men were given over to their own reprobate minds. Hundreds and at last thousands were executed daily. People sought to forget their sorrows in a delirium of present enjoyments. All the theaters of Paris were open as usual during the whole Reign of Terror, and they were never fuller. When the nobles and the higher orders of the old society were dead, the guillotine began to descend on the shopkeepers and the more opulent of the laboring classes, and it was only in reaction to this that an end was put to the Reign of Terror. Meanwhile, war was declared by France against Great Britain. These vials overrun each other, and the judgments of one do not necessarily cease when the next is poured out. But the second bowl, in verse 3, was poured out on the sea. The sea was turned into blood, and every living thing in the sea died. The blood of a dead man was congealed, or a blackish blood like the purplish face of a corpse. The sea, indicating that the sea would become discolored, the effect of great quantities of blood that were shed on its water. We should expect a fulfillment here that will focus on a time of major maritime battles. There's a likeness between the first four vials and the first four trumpets, and I think that's very important. By the way, the word vial comes from the original Greek word that's translated here as bowl or vial. The King James translators used the word vial because of that Greek word. I don't know about you. When I think of a vial, I think of something that's long and narrow and you can pour out just a little bit of it. But these were bowls like were used for the scattering of the ashes in the time of the tabernacle or the temple. These were flat, basin-like bowls, and you can just toss and fling material out of it. That's the idea here, more than what I think of when I hear the English word vial. So I think bowl, for our time and place, is probably a better expression. The scene and the subject in the case of the first four bowls and the first four trumpets are just almost the same. Earth, sea, rivers, and sun. But in the trumpets were being told about 1/3 of the earth and the rivers and the sea and the sun. In these bowls, they are spoken of as entire. The eastern division of the empire, together with the Illyrian portion, had been taken by the Turkish conquest. It had been annihilated in its political character as a so-called Christian state. And so there is a fall here. The third part of men had been killed in their collective and political character under the sixth trumpet. Right after that, the rest of the men that were not killed are spoken of. Papal Europe was left as the remaining Christendom on the old Roman earth. Lord willing, we'll take it up at this point in the morning and talk a little bit more about the second bowl and try to proceed throughout the rest of the bowls, and then in our second session tomorrow talk about the 17th chapter and the 20th chapter. 10-minute break. Thank you.